This is Rage, Radio Against the Global Ecocide. Today on the show, Holocaust Collapse and Despair with Wazia Tawi. Music by resident antihero, Dr. Israel and Seven. This is Rage, building a community of resistance, one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to Rage, Radio Against the Global Ecocide. Coming to you from occupied Amiskwasiwiskaigan, I am your host, Seymour Life. And a special hello to all those working to return indigenous lands back to the people. Today, another great interview with Wazia Tawi. We are talking about the North American Holocaust, Collapse, and Despair. I started the interview by asking her about how to define Holocaust in the North American context.
I would identify it as one Holocaust of the Western Hemisphere, and I would say it's a Holocaust that not only included the genocide of millions of indigenous populations of human beings, but also populations of animals and plants, and it's been a Holocaust that is so massive that I think it is to see. To understand it, I guess, in its entirety, it is helpful to think of it as one massive Holocaust.
Well, then let's talk about the Indigenous Holocaust. First, in general terms, as you see them, and then in terms of your own people.
Right. Well, when I think about the Indigenous Holocaust as it refers to human beings, the numbers are so stunning that it's very difficult to really comprehend that in the Western Hemisphere, we figure that indigenous populations were exterminated at a rate of 98.5%.
Mm-hmm.
That means that really only 1.5% of the populations continued to live. And, you know, if you can imagine a group of 100 people and only one or two people surviving out of that 100 and thinking about how do you continue on, how do you survive, how do you continue your culture, your way of life, at the same time that there's this devastation to the planet, it becomes really stark. And there aren't too many examples in human history where there has been that high of an extermination rate in terms of percentages. And so it's really a horrendous thing. For the population of my people, the Dakota Oyate, the Dakota Nation, you know, I would say that we suffered about the same population percentage of loss, and our people are clearly suffering as a consequence. I don't think that we've ever healed from that. I don't think that we've ever recovered from that. And I think what makes it particularly devastating is that along with the physical genocide, the extermination of our people and our lands, that there was also this tremendous effort at the complete extermination of our cultures, of our spiritualities, of our way of life. And had it just been, and I don't want to say just lightly, because in this case it's obviously very serious, but if it had just been the extermination of our physical bodies, our populations might have been able to eventually recover, although obviously we'd be forever changed. But with the devastation to our cultures and spirituality, it's made it that much more devastating, that much more profound in terms of the destruction to our people and our way of life.
In our last conversation, you also mentioned that there's a lot of silencing and denial of the experience of Holocaust that the indigenous peoples went through. And I think that we can also, as you point out, we expand that to plants and animals and other indigenous beings. But why do you think there is that kind of denial, that kind of silencing and looking away of the Holocaust?
Right. You know, I think that there are a couple of things at work here. And one of the things that we know is that in order for people to commit acts of genocide, the perpetrators really have to believe in the inhumanity of others. If they believe that they are inferior beings, inferior human beings in this case, then it allows them to perpetrate these horrendous crimes against humanity while also believing in the righteousness of their actions. And so I think that along with that is that they also have to minimize the harm as a way to rationalize it. And I should qualify that because I would say, I guess, that I think that that is probably more true of the beneficiaries of genocide rather than the original perpetrators of a particular crime of genocide. And so in this context, I think, especially in North America, we hear over and over again, first of all, we heard for centuries that there weren't that many people here anyway.
Yeah.
That estimates, I think, in North America were about 1.2 million by early estimates, largely from anthropologists. And I think so much of that was directly tied to a desire to minimize the impact, to say that this was a land that wasn't populated, and therefore whatever happened to the original populations, yes, they might have been wiped out, they might have been exterminated, but they were a small number anyway, and they were not occupying much land, and so it all goes into creating this myth, but a myth that allows them to feel better about their ongoing occupation of our lands. The other thing I think that is particular to this context is the devastation from disease. And so Americans, and I think Canadians too, are probably taught from a very early age that the major cause of death to Indigenous populations in the Western Hemisphere was disease, and that that is inevitable, that that cannot be controlled. And so we're taught then to accept genocide as inevitable outcome of this contact between the old world and the new. And I think all of that is of course, a myth, in that we know that, yes, obviously Indigenous populations were absolutely devastated by diseases, but that the conquest, other aspects of killing, of moving populations, attacking food sources or destroying food sources, all of those means were used to facilitate not just the immediate physical death, but slower death through starvation, through disease. Mm-hmm. And in other contexts, when we look at the Jewish Holocaust, for example, when people die of starvation in the concentration camps, we don't say, they weren't killed if they died of starvation. If they died of disease, we don't say, oh, that was just inevitable. That's not really genocide. But in the North American context, we're very much taught to look at disease and starvation as being as if they're disconnected from the physical act of conquest. And I would say that those three things are inextricably linked. And I think most importantly, I think that the silence continues today and the denial continues today because people generally do recognize that if genocide has been perpetrated, it requires some kind of reparative justice. And I know in the American context especially, there is absolutely no desire on the part of settlers to engage in acts of reparative justice. And I think it's very frightening, in fact, for them to think about the potential of that in terms of their own privilege and their own power within this particular land base.
When you say that, I was down in Colorado last year, and we were at a wedding, and my partner was talking with a lawyer, because there was some lawyers there that involved, and I think it was a lawyer. The groom was a member of a firm, and some of the people there were from that. And they were talking about the Afro-American experience with the law. And then so my partner said, well, what about Indigenous peoples, and what is their experience? And the guy just looked at her with a blank face. He had no idea what to say.
Right.
You know, and she couldn't believe it. Like, she went and started talking about, you know, what about this, what about that? And because, you know, it's just like they didn't exist. And it's like the thought never even crossed his mind.
Right. Absolutely invisible.
Yeah, exactly. And I saw another piece on that Another thing that just reminded me of it, because obviously I was going to have this conversation with you, and I was looking at a video that somebody had recommended that people look at, and I was looking at it on YouTube, and they started talking about civil rights. And again, civil rights was, you know, the African-American experience, you know, the Jewish experience and things like that. And I'm looking, where's the indigenous experience? It's like, it's just, right. You know, it's not brought up at all in any context there.
Right.
Again, why I think, you know, when you said that, it just twigged. And the other thing that also twigged was Theodore Roosevelt, when he was talking about, he wrote something about the buffalo, saying how wonderful creature it was, a majestic, large creature. But, and as sad as it, and I think the quote is, as sad as it made him, it was necessary to eliminate them for the progress of civilization. Exact quote. I thought that was just absolute. When I heard that, I was just stunned. But at the same time, you're not surprised by the statement.
Right. I mean, and we know that it was General Phil Sheridan's policy that was applied mainly through the 1870s regarding the extermination of the buffalo, and knowing full well that the extermination of the buffalo would mean that subsistence would be denied to indigenous populations on the Great Plains especially, mm-hmm. and other populations who relied on the buffalo as an essential component of their diet and the way of life. And one of the demographers, Sherburne Cook, noted that by 1864, the policy was to wear the Indians down by keeping them moving and preventing them from laying in supplies of food and ammunition, and also by preventing women and children from resting. So I think in that, the buffalo is an excellent example, because you see the combination of factors that will all lead to the same thing, and that's the extermination of the buffalo and the people, our peoples. But so oftentimes they're disconnected from the understandings in the minds of most settlers.
How do you think that this denial and the silencing has affected your people?
Well, you know, I think this really relates to the issue of despair. Mm-hmm. And as I was thinking about the issue of despair, one of the things I kept coming back to was a notion of inconsolable grief. And this, I really thought about this the first time in the context of the Dakota commemorative marches, which I helped to organize and I participated in, well, since 2002, four times, 2002, 2004, 2006, and again in 2008. And we're getting ready to walk again in November of 2010. Mm. But the Dakota Commemorative March is a 7-day, 150-mile walk that roughly retraces the route that our ancestors were forced marched in the winter of 1862. And it roughly follows the Minnesota River Valley, goes from the Lower Sioux Agency to the concentration camp at Fort Snelling. And this forced march was part of the first phase of our forced expulsion from our homeland of Minnesota. And so in the spring of 1863, after we had spent the winter in the concentration camp at Fort Snelling, our people were then shipped on boats that went down the Mississippi River and then eventually up the Missouri River and brought to a reservation in South Dakota called Crow Creek. So the commemorative march was about, you know, honoring and remembering our ancestors, but also really allowing ourselves the opportunity to publicly and collectively grieve what happened in this particular context and how difficult it was for our ancestors, because we have many stories about the killings, the beatings, the harassment by white settlers, the killings of babies, starvation, disease, the cold, the tiring walk, all of those things that were a part of that experience, as well as all of the death that accompanied the imprisonment in the concentration camp at Fort Snelling. And someone else had suggested to me, a friend from Arizona had suggested, that what we're experiencing really is the sense of inconsolable grief, because I was talking about how I've never felt healed through the experience. But I thought the more that I walked, and the more that I publicly spoke about the stories in my family, about what happened during that time period, that I would feel a sense of healing as a consequence. And I realized I wasn't feeling that healing. It wasn't it wasn't getting easier to walk. It wasn't getting easier to explore those memories because it's such a difficult place. You're talking about something like genocide and ethnic cleansing from our homeland. We don't have ceremonies, for example, within Dakota culture that address how to heal from genocide. So we're really having to make this up as we go. We're having to work through this process because it's something that historically our people didn't have to encounter before. And I really love what Derek Jensen says about despair in terms of talking about the complexity of human emotion and that it's important that we live lives in which we can experience both despair and joy. And so one of my favorite stories that came out of the whole commemorative march experience came from one of my aunties from Lower Sioux, Lydia Conito, who was talking about her grandparents or great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents. I'm not sure how many generations they were removed from her, but she talked about Fort Snelling was the place where her grandparents fell in love.
Mm.
And when she said that, it was so stunning to me because I had been in this place of inconsolable grief. And then realized, well, of course, at Fort Snelling, people would fall in love. People would find each other. They would develop new relationships, new bonds. Babies would have been born during that time. And how can a mother not love or feel joy at the birth of a baby? So knowing that as human beings, we really have to appreciate the despair and the joy simultaneously. I think those things are absolutely connected.
Have we defined in your mind this?
Yeah, you know, what I would say is that I think that many of our people have also rarely never recover from that place of despair, and I think it's very immobilizing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when I look at the lessons from our own history as Dakota people and what has happened to the spirit of our people through colonization, a couple of things always hit me pretty strong. And one is that when we first faced invasion of our lands and military conquest, our people, even at that time, which would have been, you know, the mid-19th century, were fighting against overwhelming odds that our population had already been devastated by disease, was already, especially in those early years, being influenced and divided politically by settlers moving in, by government agents, by missionaries, by traders who are all working to break down our way of life and our sense of unity. And so when the war finally broke out, it was our people, in fact, were divided over the war. And even in the face of those overwhelming odds, the leader of resistance who emerged at that time was one of our chiefs, Little Crow. And one of his quotes from that time, he says, "I tell you, we must fight and perish together. A man is a fool and coward who thinks otherwise and who will desert this nation at such a time. Disgrace not yourselves to those who will hang you up like dogs, but die, if die you must, with arms in your hands like warriors and braves of the Dakota." And every time I think about his call, knowing he knew at the time that all of the men who fought would likely die, but he was going to die anyway, he was going to fight anyway in defense of our land and way of life, I feel such a fierce sense of pride in those words. And I think that what we've faced since then is a loss of that spirit of resistance among many Dakota people, that rather than feeling, even against overwhelming odds, that we can fight or we should fight, that we have an obligation to fight against those who would harm us or harm our homelands, that we instead have given over to despair and become immobilized in the process.
That's a great quote.
Sorry. I know. I just love that one.
In this case, then, for you personally, how do you deal or how do you work with despair in your life?
You know, I'm not... this is such an interesting question because I certainly don't feel like I have any answers, and I'm not always very good at dealing with it very well. But I think one of the most important lessons that I've learned over the years is that we need to acknowledge it first and foremost. And I think one of the most important lessons I learned came from a friend of mine. Her name is Gabrielle Tateyushkanshkan. She's from Assistant, South Dakota. And we were in a situation where we were publicly speaking about some of the things, our history, some of the things that had happened to our people. And it was in a situation where it was mostly a settler audience, and tears, you know, were streaming down my face as I'm talking. And we're taught in this society that tears are inappropriate, that when you're publicly talking, especially in professional context or in public context, that we shouldn't cry. And she said at the time, she said, never apologize for crying. Those tears are a reflection of your humanity. It means that you can still feel, you're still human. And that was such an important lesson for me, I think, because it's undoing one of the ways that settler society teaches us to disconnect from ourselves, from our humanity. Mm-hmm. And to reject that outright and to say that, no, if I'm hurting, if I'm feeling sad, that that's a natural expression, and to not be ashamed of that and, in fact, hold tight to that. Because when we stop crying, that means we aren't feeling things the same way. That's one of the ways that I come to deal with despair, is that my emotions are always laid out there. I'm not very good at disguising it, and I really don't want to be, that I feel like that's a reflection of humanity. And I think that for me, especially when we're thinking about the changes that are happening right now and where many people from settler society feel a sense of despair because there's an acknowledgement that this way of life is coming to an end, and there's maybe discomfort, uncertainty about what to do from here, and also a tremendous amount of fear because of the toxicity, because of the harm to the plants, the animals, the land, the waters, the topsoil. There's so much to be fearful of that people can get wrapped up in that. And for Indigenous populations, at least for me, and I can't speak for all Indigenous people, but I suspect that many Indigenous people feel something else along with that, feel a sense of hope, because what we're seeing is the end of industrial civilization, and there is hope there, and that because most of us come from traditions that have talked about what will happen, have talked about this time period, and there's also teachings about us carrying on living through these periods. So I bring that, I remind myself of that a lot, that this also, I think, signifies the rebirth of our people. And I also know that the populations of Indigenous people today who are still living, those of us who have survived, come from a long legacy of strong people. And I believe that we will have the capacity to get through and to do whatever we need to do to make sure that our people survive and ultimately to bring integrity back to our homelands.
How do you see collapse? What do you see as collapse? Do you see collapse as an ongoing slow thing, a quick thing? How do you see collapse as a whole?
Well, I think that that when we cross a certain threshold, that things are going to unravel pretty quickly. And it's one of the things that I think people always are fearful to talk about or to project timetables on, mm-hmm. because none of us really knows. But I think that for some Indigenous populations, and I've heard in different elders from different nations talk about this, I've heard elders from my own nation talk about this, that what we're seeing here, what the things that are happening also signify the rebirth of our nations. And I think that there are things that we're going to see in our lifetimes. I think my children are going to see this in their lifetimes. And that rebirth is going to happen simultaneously with the collapse of settler society and settler ways of being. Again, even when I'm thinking about collapse, thinking about how it will play out, I don't have the same level of fear. I see that, you know, what's happening is that we're witnessing the ultimate vindication of our ways of being, and unfortunately, devastatingly, it also is happening along with the devastation of the animals, the plants, the waters, the topsoil, the air, everything around us. But because I'm not someone who's invested in maintaining those ways of being, I'm very optimistic about what we can bring back once collapse actually occurs.
Now, you touched on this as well already a little bit, but what do your people need to heal?
You know, at one time I thought that to heal, that truth-telling was an essential component of that, and that perhaps that was enough, that we would reach catharsis through truth-telling, and I've since abandoned that. And what I realize more and more every day is that healing is directly connected to justice. Mm. And I think for me, that justice looks like a way for us to renew our relationship with our homelands and all of its beings and work toward protecting this particular land base that is our homeland. And in the Dakota context, what has been so devastating to all of us as a whole has been our disconnect from our lands, from one another, since after exile, we've really experienced a diaspora. And so we have populations spread out through the United States and Canada. And so we've missed out on that sense of connection and community that would have been so much a part of our daily lives prior to colonization and prior to us being forced out of our homeland. So justice then and healing then, I think, is only going to come when we can reconnect with our homeland and with one another in the deepest way, and that's by returning home and reestablishing our relationships with all of the beings within our homeland.
I think that's one thing I think a lot of people are not paying attention, and most people aren't, is that just how broken up the communities are.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, because I know that in the eastern part of Canada it's quite a bit broken up, in the western part a little less so, but still fairly fractured. And I think in the U.S. it's really largely forced migrations. Both the Cherokee of your people has really emphasized that they just, because they just pushed them and then they just broke them further. And I think even, and I want to clarify this, is that I believe that at one point Oklahoma was sort of a spot where they pushed everyone to it, and then from there they broke up again. But even I think the Apache were pushed towards or relocated, or some of them were relocated to Oklahoma. And that was pretty much a very common practice of that relocation of groups or fracturing groups.
Absolutely, yeah. Into what was Indian territory. Of course, other indigenous peoples already lived there. Mm-hmm. And so indigenous groups, usually from the east, were forced onto other indigenous peoples' lands in Indian territory. But that was supposed to be Indian territory forever, and of course for most of it turned into the state of Oklahoma.
If we're really going to get through this and there's any kind of reconciliation, there has to be that recognition of what happened to the indigenous people. And also at the same time, is that possible, and how do we go forward, and then at the same time bring down the systems that are destroying the planet? There seems to be some pieces there that need to mesh somehow, but how do we get that meshing?
Right. Well, I'm not exactly sure about that yet, but yeah. This is what I think. I think that what I need to see is an indigenous person seeking allies from settler society in terms of trying to build a different future. That first and foremost, what I need to see is people rejecting the ways of settler society, rejecting the institutions, rejecting the systems, realizing the inherent destructiveness of them and being committed to eradicate them. And, you know, I don't think, for example, I don't think any of us can experience healing. I don't think the planet can experience healing unless people work to bring down those systems that are working to destroy the planet. So you can't have things going on this way, things continuing this way, and then feel like you're working on healing because it's the destruction is happening every single day. I think that first and foremost, what I'd like to see is settlers taking a firm position to stop trying to save this way of life, but instead recognize that this way of life is destructive, and therefore we all need to work towards bringing it down as quickly as possible. And from there, we can work on establishing better relations with one another and with the lands.
It's the thing that you run up against any time when you talk with people. They get their thresholds, and I always call it going down the rabbit hole, and I kind of put that in my question about despair. And as people go down the rabbit hole and they start going, okay, this system is destroying the planet, and they start going through and they start hitting thresholds where either they want to start going back out the hole because they don't like this, where it's going, or they try to look for side doors. Going back out the hole, I call trying to find the right consciousness groups, and if we're all going at the right time when the planets are aligned the right way, everything's going to be okay.
right.
You know, and the other kind of, you know, side doors are, well, if we just do green jobs or if we do lifestyle changes and things like that, that's enough. And I guess that's where I came up with the question in my mind is that, how are people dealing with that fact? And for myself, I see it. We go down this hole, we go all the way. A lot of people are going to die because we are believing on an infrastructure that is so tenuous.
Right. Well, and I think that when you follow this path and you are trying to keep your eyes open, that your circle of friends gets very small.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so much of what we're expected to do on a daily basis seems absolutely meaningless. And it's hard. I think what's very difficult right now is this in-between state, because I know that things won't continue like this much longer, but we have to, in some ways, still participate in so that we can live, so that we can eat, so that we can keep up the appearances of going along. But it's hard. But, you know, I mean, I'm thankful for the work that you've been doing. I think it's so important, and it allows people to make connections, and it's the same thing with Derek's work, too, because he is speaking to people, but usually we're disconnected from one another.
Fact is that to an extraordinary extent, by comparative standards, the United States is a business-run society, which means that human rights are subordinated to the overwhelming, overriding need of profit for investors. Decisions are placed in the hands of unaccountable private tyrannies, which means that even if formal democratic practices exist as they do, they're of peripheral significance. The government, in fact, is, as John Dewey called it 50 or 60 years ago, the shadow cast by business over society.
Conveyor belt, American homogeny. We construct the mold, then we feed it to the progeny. We can run the world like it's our private property. This is the age of industry, and ain't nobody stopping me. Conveyor belt, American homogeny. We construct the mold, then we feed it to the progeny. We can run the world like it's our private property. This is the age of industry, and ain't nobody stopping me. Big business man making dividends is the plan. Take a little off the top and keep our workers disciplined. Watch them munching while I go to lunch and catch me at the bar for so the corporate function. Consumer marketeer, tell them what they want to hear. The machine runs itself, I don't really have to try. Promotional themes tell you what you need to buy. Penetrate your mind just to keep your pocket dry. Keep the profits high, we never stop it. Why? Cause the truth is in my wallet, whatever you want to call it. Cutthroat opportunists, every time that I do this, I receive heavy return without any concern for what it is that I'm selling. And there ain't no really telling in between my actions and those of a common felon. Except I cover my tracks, the government's got my back, marking my P's and Q's, making sure I never lose. Conveyor belt, American homogeny. We construct the mold, then we feed it to the progeny. We can run the world like it's our private property. This is the age of industry, and ain't nobody stopping me. Conveyor belt, American homogeny. We construct the mold, then we feed it to the progeny. We can run the world like it's our private property. This is the age of industry, and ain't ain't nobody stopping me.
Big business man making dividends is the plan. Take a little off the top and keep my workers disciplined. Watch them punching while I go to luncheon. Catch me at the golf course as a corporate function. Consumer marketeer, tell them what they want to hear. The machine runs itself, I don't really have to try. Promotional teams tell you what you need to buy. Penetrate your mind just to keep your pockets dry. Keep the profits high, we never stop it, why? Cause the truth is in my wallet, whatever you want to call it. Cutthroat opportunists, every time that I do this I receive every return without any concern for what it is that I'm selling. And there ain't no really telling in between my actions and those of a common felon. Except I cover my tracks, the government's got my back. Marking my P's and Q's, making sure I never lose.
Conveyor belt, American homogeny. We construct the mold, then we feed it to the progeny. We can run the world like it's our private property. This is the age of industry, and ain't nobody stopping me. Conveyor belt, American homogeny. We construct the mold, then we feed it to the progeny. We can run the world like it's our private property. This is the age of industry, and ain't nobody stopping me.
Social policy is geared to the transfer of wealth and power to those who already have it, and deliberately so. Deliberately so. Social policy is geared to the transfer of wealth and power, and deliberately so.
Conveyor belt, American homogeny. We construct the mold, then we feed it to the progeny. We can run the world like it's our private property. This is the age of industry, and ain't nobody stopping me. Conveyor belt, American homogeny. We construct the mold, then we feed it to the progeny. We can run the world like it's our private property. This is the age of industry, and ain't nobody stopping me.
And that was Resident Antihero with Conveyor Belt. In my interview with Zia Tawi, we dealt mostly with the human holocaust. But there was, and is, a complete human and non-human holocaust that has occurred and ongoing in North America. Fire is part of the definition of a holocaust. And fire was the preferred method of clearing the land of forest, but also of the indigenous peoples, prior to the Industrial Revolution. In the last 500 years, there has been such a wanton slaughter of life in the so-called land of the free, to make the word holocaust almost common, without its usual sense of horror. It makes holocaust appear to be no more than progress. In fact, it is progress. Taking us out is Dr. Israel and Seven with Get the Fuck Up. Thank you for listening, and remember, the resistance needs you.
Social injustice is an indecision.